carry no sweets, only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. I'm from the old school, my household smell like soul food, bro. Curry falafel.
What's up, Beardos? Welcome to episode 98 of The Bearded Vegans. I'm Paul.
And I'm Andy.
And we are The Bearded Vegans, a podcast featuring a dissection of all things vegan.
If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find all of our previous episodes at thebeardedvegans.com. And you can always reach us by emailing thebeardedvegans@gmail.com.
In today's episode, we will talk about what we've been eating and then move on into an in-depth discussion with a very special guest.
And before we get into that, a few announcements. I, Andy, will be speaking at Chicago Vegan Mania on September 23rd with Laura of the Herbivorous Butcher. It should be a fun time.
Yeah, and then one other announcement. We have our episode 100 coming up, which... I mean, being exciting, it's a 100 episode, but also that means it's our mailbag episode, so if you have any questions or submissions, feel free to send those in to our email, thebeardedvegans@gmail.com.
All right, so let's have some fun, Paul.
Yeah.
So I can't help but notice something is a little different today.
Something is a little different, Andy. We are recording live from the Toronto Veg Food Festival, so that's pretty good. This is our second live recording ever.
Yes.
Andy, how many people were at the first one?
Five.
Five people. So this is a few more people. There's, I don't know, maybe 10,000?
Yeah, I think roughly 10,000.
About.
So, Paul, this is actually your first time in Canada.
It is, yes.
What do you think so far?
It's great. Everyone is incredibly nice, stereotypically so.
Some might say a little too nice.
A little too nice.
Like, it's to the point where you're like, what do you want from me?
And my one qualm, it was very hot during the day, and it's very cold at night. And not used to that.
Not predictable.
Choose one.
Well, it's been like 10 years since I've been in Canada, and things have changed a little bit, and it's... a little unsettling sometimes. It's like trying to figure out what the money is, and you just hand it to people, and you're like, figure this out for me, please. But anyway, so I know Kevin already asked, but who here is a beardo in the crowd? By applause, yes. Thank you. So for those of you that are just joining us for the first time, we are a podcast, and we like to have in-depth discussions about like the ethical gray areas of veganism, and we kind of go by this philosophy of sometimes it's just more important to have the conversation than to have any specific answer. And we have a certain format, but we had something planned out, and then we were graced with this amazing special guest, so we're going a little off script from the topic that was advertised for this particular panel, but I think what we have is significantly better. So I guess, without further ado, let's do this.
Yeah, so you may know her as the author of The Sexual Politics of Meat and the co-author of the new book, Even Vegans Die. Please welcome Carol Adams.
Carol, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to be with both of you, Paul and Andy.
Yes, I think that when we first started the podcast, we had a list of people that were like, we would love to have them on, and you made that short list of people. So we're finally making a dream come true today.
I only had to come to Toronto to get onto a podcast from the United States.
So before we get into the serious stuff, let's talk about food a little bit. We always like to talk about what we've been eating. Has there been anything you've eaten since you've gotten into town that was really impressive to you?
I ate at how do you pronounce it? The new plant-based restaurant here. I had some gnocchi, delicious, in a deep mushroom sauce, some cauliflower ravioli with truffle grated on top in front of me, a grilled artichoke in a mustard sauce, a deep curried lentil soup, a flatbread filled with peppers and eggplant and a little hummus.
Is that it? That's it?
I think there was one more course. We finally said, don't bring us anymore.
I gotta say, yeah, Toronto, you have a pretty fantastic food scene going on, like too many places to even try. Paul, you got a favorite from the festival?
From the festival so far, I really liked Rescue Dogs. They were great. I got the Rescue Dog. The titular rescue dog, and it was just like smothered in chili. It was phenomenal. It was great. They seemed like great people working there, so it was great. What about you, Andy?
It's fun being able to say the name of a restaurant and hearing a crowd cheer about it. Normally when we record, we are hundreds of miles apart from each other, and I am sitting in a van with like a microphone hoping the cops don't like knock on my window. I have to say, we had the Big Mac from Globally Local, which has like a probably 2 hour long line right now. It was really nice because there's a lot of places that do a vegan Big Mac, but they make their own like chickpea patty. So it's not trying to be a meaty thing. It's just its own delicious thing. So I feel like that probably takes top honors, although Idle Vital out there was, yeah.
So good.
I think they might take the cake for me right now. So yeah, so that's what we've been eating. Let's get into some discussion with Carol here. The first question we always love to ask is, how did you go vegan? Why did you go vegan? What did that journey look like for you?
So in 1974, I became a vegetarian after my pony was killed by some teenagers who were target practicing behind our pasture. And that night I sat and I was about to eat a hamburger and I stopped and I thought, I'm eating a dead cow. I would not eat my pony who just died. We're going to bury him tomorrow. Why am I eating a dead cow? And I realized I was a hypocrite. I was able to ask those questions because I was already a feminist, and I knew that consciousness raising was about recognizing when the personal is political. About 2 weeks after I became a vegetarian, I realized there were connections between feminism and vegetarianism, and that began my path to the sexual politics of meat. Fast forward 10 years, I'm reading a 19th century book that talks about meat as animalized protein. And I thought, well, if meat is animalized protein, that the protein source is vegetable, but it's put through a body, what is dairy and eggs? So I coined a term because we did not have one that suited my theoretical interests. So I coined the term feminized protein. And once I coined the term and thought about its repercussions about the sexual exploitation of cows and chickens, I became a vegan.
Right on. And so you've written the, yeah. And so your seminal work, The Sexual Politics of Meat.
Let's just stop there. My ovular work.
Sorry. We're learning something new every day. What was like the climate like in the animal rights movement when you decided to write that? Like what was the reasoning for that? Why did you say, I need to put this to paper?
It was, I was possessed with this, but I was possessed with this in 1974, which means it's before animal liberation. And I think we make a big mistake that in the animal rights movement, if you look at the histories that are told in books or whatever, we've got this very sort of father-oriented story. But in fact, there were women writing in the 1960s about this. And feminists in the 1970s were talking about vegetarianism, talking about animal exploitation. And all of that becomes sort of invisible the minute we mark the beginning of the animal rights movement in 1975. I'm not saying that's what you did, but it's... No, I'm really not saying that. But I'm just saying that traditionally that's what we do. And so we fail to see the kind of feminist interventions that had been going on. In the early years, I wasn't as much involved. I was a grassroots activist in upstate New York around racism and welfare issues and migrant worker issues. So I wasn't directly involved. I followed a lot of the work, and one of the most important periodicals I got was from England. It was called The Beast. Is that right? It was incredible. And generally, the reaction to when I would say I was doing this book, people would say, yeah, I've noticed that when women eat meat, they're very aggressive. Or, yeah, macrobiotics thinks that men should not be eating this. Or it was like, no, that's not what I'm saying. I think that there were some of us out there all around the world thinking thoughts like this, and that when The Sexual Politics of Meat was published, there were a lot of people that were just sort of relieved, like someone has articulated the fact that animal rights is a social justice issue. And perhaps that's what had been missing in the 80s, was we were so busy doing animal rights, we did not have a theory that sort of placed it within a larger context around other social justice issues like misogyny.
So like in the 80s, in the animal rights advocacy movement, because what I've noticed is today, it seems like, especially on like social media and stuff like that, the most kind of prominent and popular vegan advocates are the ones that are like the loudest and the most aggressive and the most, you know, like masculine. And has it kind of always been like that, where those are the types of people that are, even if there's other people doing work that is just as important, if not more important, or just as effective, if not more effective, were those always kind of the people that were getting the major props?
Well, I think we have to acknowledge that the animal rights movement is largely women, but that in our culture, women's voices aren't valued as much as men's voices. And so, for instance, I heard stories from women in the 80s. She was the president, a man was the vice president of the local animal rights group. And when the media would come to interview them about a march or a protest, the reporter would turn directly to the man and say, "Tell us why you're doing this." And then I'd hear from other grassroots activists, and they'd say, "We were so grateful when someone like Jim Mason, a wonderful animal rights activist and writer, would come to our community, because finally the media would turn out and hear us because a man was speaking." So I don't think it's inherent to the animal rights movement to favor men, though I think we do have a problem with misogyny in the movement. I think it's symbolic of a larger problem in our culture of who's listened to.
Do you feel like that has changed over time, like since you wrote The Sexual Politics of Me, or is it just kind of the same old song and dance?
It's probably more mixed now. I think we've got other layers of problems. I think the decision by one animal rights group to parade naked or semi-naked women has influenced grassroots activists, so that when grassroots activists call a local paper and say, we're going to do this protest, the paper says, "Well, is anybody going to be naked? We're only coming if someone's going to be naked." So we've got a problem of how are we heard? What is it that we're doing that matters enough to be heard? And so we're struggling with that. I want to go back to the angry thing, of course. I'm very worried about that. I feel like that there's a certain trend by some people that if we're angry and if we're sort of bullish, to use a terrible metaphor, and especially I see this among some men, that haranguing women around dairy and saying dairy is rape and being very insensitive to the fact that a large majority of women in our culture have been victims of rape or other form of sexual violence. So I feel there's a sort of appropriation by a group of angry men of a conversation that should be happening in a different way. So I see that too.
How would you like to see that conversation happen?
Well, I'd like to see the men lay off that conversation. or they could give the book, The Sexual Politics of Meat, say, "Hey, this book was really helpful to me." But it's gotta be a conversation. Also, why not let feminists talk to feminists? We don't need that help. There is a whole bunch of people out in the world who aren't vegans. Why not leave a feminist conversation to feminists? And why not tackle those other white men in the world who should be going vegan too?
Yeah, and I know we've had people on the show before talk about how you're going to be the most effective advocate to the person that's the most like you. And like you said, there are plenty of white men out there, so might as well just try to tackle those people, because it's more likely that you're going to break through to them anyways.
Yeah. And there's not a power differential.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, so you were mentioning the men in the movement getting like all this spotlight. And so I wanted to kind of transition to some conversations I had at the Animal Rights Conference this year. And it's conversations I feel like are repeated. I'm sure you've had them a million times, which was sort of this idea that there are a lot of men in the movement, and actually, let me sidetrack for a second, because I wanted to call them predatory men, but you've talked about how you don't think that that term actually does it justice. I wonder if you could expand on that a little bit.
So that's tied in with work by other ecofeminists, and for those listening and here, ecofeminism is a specific kind of feminism that's looking at the way a variety of oppressions are connected, including the environment, and for us, animals, and brings a feminist perspective to that. But some of us ecofeminists were talking about how when you talk about sexual predators, what are we doing? We're naturalizing. First of all, we're naturalizing something. It's a decision by men to sexually exploit. But we're also misunderstanding what predation is out in the wild. And we're misusing that term. So I use the term serial sexual exploiters or one-time sexual exploiters. But I prefer not to use predation because we're animal rights activists. Predators have a role in the world. The predators are, we know what's going on in the United States, in Washington and other Western states where wolf packs are being killed to protect cattle that are being pastured on federal land. So to use predation in a negative way, I don't think is an appropriate thing for us to do as animal rights activists.
Right on. So we will call them serial sexual exploiters or one-time exploiters. And so the conversation kind of being that people will sort of mention, oh, there are some men in this movement or a lot of men in this movement that sort of are out there and they get a pass. But like a lot of people that are sort of in the movement know. There's kind of this knowing like, like we know who you're talking about. And so I guess we want to have a little bit of a conversation about like, why is it so hard to protect the people in the movement that are being victimized by them? Why is it so hard to name names and sort of, you know, get them out to make a safer place for those within the movement? I know that's like a
Four questions? No, I don't mean to laugh at this. It's a very serious subject and it's very difficult. Well, it's hard to name a name if you're going to get sued. And not just in this movement, but often the other area I've worked in is clergy sexual harassment. Well, the minute you want to bring seven women who are going to charge a clergy person with sexual exploitation, they often are going to say, I'm going to sue you for libel. And that's also happened in the animal rights movement. So it's hard to name a name if you know you're going to be sued. And I think we have to recognize that. The other thing is, just like in society at large, many women who have been victimized don't want to name it. They want to get on with their lives. And unfortunately, the way for them to get on with their lives is that they have to leave the movement. The third problem is that some of the men are seen as so dynamic that it's thought that it would hurt the movement for us to name them and out them and hold them responsible. And so at the Animal Rights Conference, where I met Paul and Andy a month ago, I talked about why does it hurt the movement for us to name the names and call to account men who are serial sexual exploiters, but it's not hurting the movement for the women who've been hurt to leave. I think the fourth thing is that because we have fewer men in the movement, they do get a pass. But it's sort of like Trump on the bus with Billy Bush. There's also, I'm sorry, I know we're in Canada, but I'm sure you've all seen that video. Go to the Washington Post, Trump on the bus with Billy Bush, in which women are being objectified. I know that there has been a climate of sort of sexual joking about women, things that kind of can be taken for granted in a patriarchal world or a misogynist world, but that seeps into the movement too, so that if we aren't living in a culture that prizes every individual for who they are and instead sees them in objectified ways, it's then hard to switch and value that because we haven't had it. We don't yet have equality for women in this world. So we're trying to find a world in which there's equality, and we don't yet have it. And I think the animal rights movement is caught in that too. And also, sometimes, some groups are pandering to a dominant culture that is misogynist. So they think they need to have men as the spokespeople, and the women as the invisible activists.
And also, I feel like a lot of times the way that these people get the pass is someone will say like, oh, but they're doing so much for the animals and we can't give them up because they're doing so much. And they use that to kind of overlook all the other stuff they're doing. But I feel like there's no one person in this movement that's going to, you know, like change the entire world for animals. And it's like, there's always going to be someone else that could be doing that same work. And there are a lot of phenomenal people doing a lot of phenomenal work, but I don't think any one person is going to be the one person that's going to change everything.
Perhaps that's our optimism. We so desperately want to change a world in which animals are harmed so terribly every day that all the things we've done haven't yet succeeded in stopping it. So maybe we become this sort of naive optimist. I mean, maybe there's a part of us in there that, oh, well, maybe that would work. Maybe that's the thing. And of course, you know, being saved by men, we've got models for that. When I met Paul and Andy at the Animal Rights Conference in Washington, I gave a plenary talk in 10 questions for the animal rights movement about the second-class status of women and the sexual exploitation of women. And since that time, I've been working on a new blog. It was going to be 10 recommendations for heterosexual men in the animal rights movement, but I sent it around to some other thoughtful people, and I'm at 25 recommendations at this point. But I just wanted to read the first one.
Please.
Be as brave in speaking out for human equality as we know you can be and have been for animals. I shouldn't have to say this, but it benefits the non-human animals as well as all of us human animals when women are treated with equality. And I don't think that's the point we've recognized, that treating women with equality will impact the movement. Too. I mean, I hate to have to appeal to our interest of saving animals to have women's equality be on the table, but it's actually true.
Definitely. I think that we often talk about on the show and sort of thinking about it strategically, because like obviously you want an inclusive movement, you want as many people in it as possible, and that means making sure it's not racist or sexist or any other horrible ist. But it always feels like icky to appeal to that. It's like we should just be good, decent people to each other. And I don't know how to have that conversation with someone if all they care about is like saving the animals. Like, what do you say to someone if they're like, well, humans are like way less oppressed than animals are, and we shouldn't care about those issues. And if you don't care about animals, I don't care about you.
Well, it reminds me of this conversation that happened, I think, on the Diane Rehm show, a show out of Washington, after the Michael Vick dogfighting developments. And somebody called in and said, well, at least battered women have a voice. These animals did not have a voice. And I thought, well, first of all, we shouldn't fetishize voice. Animals already have voices. We're not listening. Animals bellow, cows cry. You know, there's a variety of voices. We are not the voice of the voiceless. We are trying to be the voice for someone who's not heard, but that creates, that's different than saying voicelessness. But the minute we start having voicelessness versus battered women can speak, there is such a misunderstanding of structural oppression there. And I think that's happening. Way back in 1994, I did an article that's in my book, Neither Man Nor Beast, and I'll just put in a plug, a new edition's coming out next year. But I was asking the question, why are some people in the movement willing to deal with their privilege over other species, but not their white privilege or their male privilege? Why is one kind of privilege okay to ask a question about, but not another? And it's because those privileges are invisible to those who have them. So the minute something's phrased that way, in this dualistic way, is to have benefited from a privilege you aren't even noticing you have.
And I guess I wanted to get back to the conversations about the problematic men in the movement a little bit. My partner is someone who was abused and spoke out and wrote an account of what happened to her. And she was subsequently sued on several different levels into silence. And that's kind of a story we see time and time again in the movement. And I'm wondering if we have any insight into how we can, I guess, not give a voice to, or is it just listening more? Like, how do we start to deal with this situation when we feel legally scared to speak out against people because they twist the legal system to re-victimize the victims?
It's very difficult, and first, I'm very sorry to hear that, and I'm sorry that that happened. And I think we need to, well, two things. Ask me it again, because I might forget, because I get kind of carried away. But I think we have to begin with the conversation that in this movement, we assume people are here because they're compassionate, because they care. And this already creates an inequality of vulnerability that a serial sexual exploiter can take advantage of, because we're in this movement and we assume the people we're talking to are equally compassionate. And this creates a sort of openness so that you end up becoming victimized because the serial sexual exploiter is misusing that trust. And so that's one of the things I added. Remember that many women in the movement assume you are compassionate because you work on behalf of non-human animals, and also that you can be trusted interpersonally. Don't abuse the vulnerability that comes with that kind of trust. But the thing is, we've got to find a way that men talk to other men about male privilege, and so that we're already holding the climate accountable, so that when there's the interpersonal violation, we have a context from that because we've been talking about it as a movement about the climate. We're in a difficult position. I mean, I wrote The Sexual Politics of Meat. How do we see that? Men thought to be wimpish if they're eating vegans, so if they're eating vegan food. So the way some vegans responded to say, you know, be plant strong and no, you're not going to lose your masculinity. Maybe we need to lose masculinity in our culture. You know, maybe that's part of the problem. Why are we going to uphold a culture of inequality and then just slip veganism in? So I think we've got a sort of meta problem of how to articulate a vision of equality and then the interpersonal thing of holding accountable.
That makes me think about, we're always trying to juggle how much is too much to like give to someone. So even in terms of like food, it's like, okay, we want people to go vegan. Well, we want them to be concerned about where their chocolate's coming from. And then what about this? And what about the bananas and the coffee and the tea and the palm oil? And like, and you feel like you're just putting too much on them. And I've heard people say like, well, if we try and we want people to go vegan, but we also want to get rid of masculinity or the patriarchy, and that's like too much. Like, how do you find that balance of trying to present these issues to people?
I say, read my book. No, it's a lot easier than getting into the arguments. No, I'm kidding. I do say that. No. Well, first, for instance, here's an example. If in a household where there's domestic violence, if we go in and we say, we know the cat's being harmed, we're going to take the cat out, but that the structure of domestic violence and harm to animals is that there'll be a new cat brought in, we're not stopping anything if we're not dealing with the larger issue of domestic violence. We can't just go in and save the animal. Well, that's what patriarchy is. The patriarchal world creates the acceptance of killing and violence as an acceptable way of us eating. I can't separate that out. I know that it's a long struggle. But I write theory. I believe we can think theoretically. I've had arguments with certain organizations. Oh, you go do your theory, Carol. We'll be activists. You know, and then they do another sexist thing. No, we're all theorists. We're all actively interacting with concepts and resisting oppressive figurations and representations and discussions and finding positive things. We're already doing that. Why don't we get to incorporate the source? The other thing is, when we're trying to make someone vegan, we're not giving them, you know, the A to Z guide to ingredients that aren't vegan. We're not saying overnight you've got to be this. We're not trying to achieve perfection, and we're not purists. We're trying to do the least harm possible. And once you learn that being vegetarian isn't enough, you're still doing a lot of harm you don't need to because of dairy and eggs. And once you learn that you could get fair traded chocolate and not the exploitation of 12-year-olds, who would not buy fair trade chocolate? I mean, if we're living and it's trying to achieve a just world, then we learn that change is possible and it doesn't end. People are afraid of change, but they're spending more time not changing than change requires. So I try to help people be liberated. I believe in vegan propaganda meals, but I never call it vegan. And then afterwards, let them incubate. I think we've become a movement that's very oriented towards rational arguments and winning a conversation, which are all sort of male-based. And a French philosopher actually coined the term carno-phallogocentrism. But take it apart, carno, meat, fallow, you got it, logocentrism, that we're, in the West, we're constituted by being speaking subjects who identify with men and eat meat. So what we're trying to change is the kind of subjectivity each of us has. And it doesn't happen overnight, but that subjectivity is going from being a subject who knows himself through having objects in his life to a subject who knows himself or themselves by knowing other subjects. We're trying to overthrow an oppressive framework, and in that process, we invite people to discover what intersubjectivity is, and that is a gift.
Right.
So I told them to kick me when I started answering long questions.
Said, please go on as long as you want. We do only have an hour, so we're trying to, that's why we brought you out right away, because you have so much great stuff to say.
So in addition to the sexual politics of meat, which is still relevant today, even though it was written, you know, a few decades ago, you just came out with Even Vegans Die. You're the co-author of that. And I feel like that tackles a lot of different issues that I haven't seen a lot of other people discussing, like disease shaming and fat shaming, which is discussed, but disease shaming is a big one that, like, whenever we watch like one of the health documentary movies or something, we're always kind of like, watching this with a skeptical eye. But what kind of like inspired you to work on Even Vegans Die?
Well, thank you for that question. And even it's sort of like I'm one of these authors who gets to write the book nobody really wants to know anything about. Like, really sexual politics? Really Even Vegans Die? No. So Patty Brightman and Ginny Messina and I were the co-authors of a book called Never Too Late to Go Vegan. And we got a grant to get some of these books into assisted living and nursing homes. So we were talking a year ago, March, and we started by talking about someone who had recently died in the vegan movement, and then Patty had to be the executor of a will, and I was talking about somebody who would not update her will, even though she takes care of very difficult foster dogs, not the run-of-the-mill dog. I said, who's your ICE in case of emergency? Who's going to come in and feed these dogs if you're in the hospital? Oh, I don't want to think about it. Oh, I don't want to think about it. If I write my will, I'm going to die. And so we started talking, and we realized that we needed to do a book. Patty thought it should be an article, and Ginny and I said, no, it's got to be a book. So we split it into three parts. The first part is about the problem if we believe that veganism is going to keep us healthy. We don't use that term in the book, the magic bullet, but it kind of works that way, that all the problems with that, there are two main problems, lots of subsidiary ones. The problem on this side is if we think veganism makes you healthy, then any unhealthy vegan is going to be treated poorly. Like, oh, you're a bad example of veganism. Oh, don't come to our vegan potlucks. You know, oh, I don't want to know about that. So first of all, we're excluding vegans whose primary identity might be veganism and not having cancer or having a yes, there we go.
Thank you, audience.
So we create a movement that is narrower than it should be and mistreats vegans in our midst. And that's part of disease shaming. But the other part is if we think veganism is keeping us healthy, we might ignore early signs of an illness in ourselves and not go to a doctor when we ought to. So it has this double effect. Besides disease shaming, we wanted to explicitly talk about fat shaming. This idea of the skinny bitch, or that I go vegan and I'm going to lose 10 pounds, or, well, do you need to lose 10 pounds? I mean, even the way the body mass index, the BMI, is calculated is being questioned. Why do we think that there is a perfect body size? Isn't that part of an oppressive system? And where does that oppress? I mean, isn't that really patriarchy? Especially the emphasis on how women look. So we feel that fat shaming is a part of disease shaming, and that the third part that happens is food shaming. Now, I'm someone who shamelessly posts wonderful blogs, I mean, wonderful photos of the foods I eat. And most people won't respond to me and say, oh my, you know, that would have fed two people in my household. Well, they're not going to say it to me, but they'll say it to somebody else. Well, so what? If somebody is enjoying food and posting beautiful vegan food, why do we have to be negative? Why do we have to judge the amount that someone's eating? And or if somebody's posting Oreos, or we're so anxious to create how wonderful vegan is that perhaps we tilt a little further than we need to towards a sense of purity. I want to move through the world with a sense of joy. If I want to try that vegan McDonald substitute, I want to do it with joy and not thinking about how many calories might be in it. So why do we have to deprive other people of the joy of their bodies and their lives? I don't think that's right. Ooh, they should have kicked me.
I highly recommend Even Vegan's Diet. It's a very quick read with like packed with tons of good information. Lots of things that I didn't think about as someone, you know, I'm 33, so I'm not thinking about end of life stuff, but it made me go, I need to be thinking about that for myself, for my parents, and a lot of other loved ones.
And your business.
And my business. I mean, it's going to die with me, but.
Yeah, you've got assets though. Sorry. That's the third part of the book. I'm
going to will my van to Paul when it's all over. But I was so appreciative to see the fat shaming being discussed in the book. And it's not like it's the only place being discussed, but to have everything so succinctly in this nice package. And you mentioned ideal body size. And a few months ago, I was at an event and I was checking out. This guy was buying shirts. He asked me how long I've been vegan. I said 10 years, and he gave me like the look, you know, he kind of like looks you up and down, and he asked me, so why aren't you at your ideal body size? And I was kind of like, I'm used to getting that online, but to like get it in person for the first time in a little while, it was kind of like, ugh, and I like froze and like time slowed down. I was like, I need to have some perfect answer and teachable moment, but I just went, I am at my ideal body size. That was like the thing that shot back right there. And it felt like in that moment, it was just a perfect sort of encapsulation of the failure of this movement to present it as like liberation or justice for animals. And instead it's all just wrapped up in this, you have to look a certain way, or if you're a certain weight, you shouldn't tell people you're vegan, you shouldn't advocate for veganism because you're a bad example of those things. So I just really appreciate that. I just wanted to say
that.
Well,
I'm sorry that happened. I'm trying to think of what another, I think I'm at my perfect body size. The other thing would be to say, well, this shirt usually goes for 20, but for you it's 30. But see, I think some of the health movies, they it's as though they've empowered us to speak to other people about health issues, or that we're sort of have become vegan experts about someone else's life. We don't know. Where's our sort of humility? We don't need vegan hubris in the world. I think veganism is invitational, but especially we don't know another person's story. So why do we presume we have the right to tell them, well, if you were vegan this, or if you were vegan that, oh, you're vegan and you're... This is kind of like the low hanging fruit of veganism, and we should be moving up the tree. I wanted to say about Even Vegans Die that we priced it very low. Specifically, it is as cheap as two vegan ice cream cones. So, because each of you listening, if you're over 21 and here, should have a will. A will goes with being an adult. It doesn't go with aging. It doesn't go with being over 50. It's not something just your parents need to do. Because especially if you're taking care of animals, who is responsible for those animals if you die? We don't want to die, but we need to be realistic. And one of the things I realized was in reading material about our fear of death, our inability to talk about death, was that it was connected with how we view animals, that we have projected a certain animality of death onto animals to keep us from dealing with it. So if anybody should be talking about death and dying and being responsible, it's vegans and animal rights activists, to help take away that sort of pallor that comes with raising death. If we could be more honest about death, maybe we can be more honest about what we're doing to animals and their deaths. So I also see it as an activist thing, but also something you owe to everybody in your life who's going to have to clean up your mess when you die. And sorry.
No, one thought I had when you were both talking about like the fat shaming and the disease shaming is, in general, it seems like a lot of times vegans, more than any other type of person, are so antsy to like catch someone doing something or tell someone that they're doing something wrong. And I think a lot of times it takes the form of disease shaming or it takes the form of fat shaming. But like even on our Instagram page, which is called The Bearded Vegans, and we post a lot of food pictures, people are constantly like, is that vegan? Like, is that American cheese in like a burger vegan or something like that? And we're like, yeah,
it's
what we do. It's our thing. But it just seems like there's a general climate in the vegan community of always wanting to be like the better vegan or catch someone. And it unfortunately, I think a lot of times takes this form because these are the easy things for people to kind of latch onto, like, oh, you're not doing this right and stuff like that.
Well, it's like there's this hierarchy of how we're going to relate. So I've told you about the beginning of the book and the end of the book. The end of the book is about end of life care and having wills and thinking about what you're going to, what's going to happen with your body. I mean, cremation, it's very environmentally destructive. So that's the end part. But the middle part is saying we need a vegan ethics of care. That the vegan movement is indebted to theories that are very based in Western Enlightenment philosophy of the individual, the autonomous individual who operates on his own. I mean, that's the model. And so we talk about animal rights or in such a way that it's a very individualized thing, but the ethics of care says that we're all interrelated. And if we have an ethics of care informed by compassion, our first response to someone isn't, you're doing something wrong. It's compassionate. It's finding a different way of relating. And so in that section, we try to explain why we haven't had a vegan ethic of care and how we might have. And then the middle part on that is about caregiving. When you learn someone who's not vegan has cancer, it is not your role to tell them to go vegan. I mean, it's a kind of, we become so anxious to help, but that is not the time to give advice. And no matter what's said, from what I understand, going vegan isn't necessarily going to reverse, you know, brain cancer. So we're zealots to a degree. And when our zealotry overwhelms our compassion, we need to recognize that's happened and step back and find a level of compassion in our walk through the world.
I think as vegans, we often feel like we just have to have answers for everything. And we're so used to someone saying, like, well, protein, you're like, okay, da 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 da. Well, what about dairy? You have like all the answers. And I think on some level, that kind of, when people are like, I am sick, I have this disease, or whatever it might be, people feel like they have to have an answer. And I think we need to cultivate sort of an environment of like, it's okay to not know, it's okay to not have the answers, it's okay to just be like, this sucks, and what can do to help you?
That's right. I mean, that's the thing to do. But that's back to the logocentrism of carnophallocentrism, that we are always in these moments where someone says, why are you a vegan? You think you're answering an innocent question, and they're going to get defensive. Now, I will say I did a whole book on this, Living Among Meat Eaters. But basically, in that book, I say the more important thing than having the answer to the question is knowing which questions not to answer. It's more important to know how to stop a conversation than to win a conversation. Because we get sucked in that if we just have all the right answers, and believe me, I have been doing this for 43 years, I could win, hands down, most conversations that someone in Dallas, where I live, wants to have with me. And what's the end result? Boy, she's bitter. Boy, she talks a lot. Boy, did you hear what she said? You think you're winning because you know that what we know is so right, in a sense. Animals are being killed. They don't need to be killed. These questions about protein, they're not asking that because they care. They're asking that only to get to the next question they're going to ask you, which could be about Hitler or about something else. They don't give a damn. And it's so important for us to realize that there are other ways to create change than to win or try to win an argument. So we get sort of sucked in, and we're like this. And by the time you finally eat your meal, it's cold. That's how they really win.
I definitely feel like when you're having discussions with other people, it's like you need to think about what they're thinking about. You need to be able to empathize with their thinking, because if you really want to be able to change their thinking, you have to understand how they're thinking. So it is very difficult, because we're all so passionate about this. It's difficult not to get kind of consumed by our emotions and want to like win the argument. But I think, like you were saying, sometimes we just need to take a step back and think about like, what's, if I crush this person logically, as what's going to be the end result of this? They're going to, like you said, they're going to think I'm a bitter person.
Right.
So I think it can be harder to have the more compassionate conversation with them than to just spout the facts and you know, that kind of stuff.
I think the other thing is to be a broken record. I learned about what happens to animals, and I did not want to be a part of it. Well, what about this? I learned what happens to animals, and I did not want to be a part of it. Well, what about Christmas? I learned what happened to animals, and I did not want to be a part of it. I mean, they're going to get it. That's called being a broken record. It's great.
All right, so we want to make sure we have a couple minutes to do some Q&A if anyone has questions out there. There's one last question I do want to ask you, which is, what do you do for yourself to prevent activist burnout? What kind of self-care do you like to partake in?
First, everybody, self-care, very important. It's okay to say no to events. It's okay to not do everything. What do I do? I love to read recipe books. I will relax reading a new vegan recipe book. I walk two rescue dogs, and because they each have their own personality issues, I can't walk them simultaneously. So I get lots of good walking. I bike. I listen to Audible mysteries and also Audible biographies. I'm listening to the biography of Alan Turing right now. Fascinating. I have a partner who's very funny, and he's taught me to be funnier than I ever was 43 years ago. So you're all benefiting from that. And I've learned to take naps.
The power of the nap. All right. Well, so Wally, do you have that wireless microphone somewhere around here? Is there anyone in the crowd that has a question for Carol or us?
This question's for Carol. So about gender inequality. Gender inequality indexes put out by all sorts of groups, United Nations, business worlds, about equal pay, there's big differences between the United States and Canada. Canada tends to rank fairly high amongst the Netherlands and things like that. And the United States tends to rank slightly below Rwanda. This is serious. What about in the movements, like the animal rights movement versus civil rights movement versus other movements? Do you have knowledge of where gender equality measurements or comparisons between those various movements?
I don't, but I hope you'll look that up and let me know. I mean, I'm not being trivial. I don't. I know that there's a wonderful book called The Dark Side of the Street about women in the civil rights movement and what happened to them and how they were also sexually vulnerable as well as vulnerable to all the other racist attacks. I think the issue of looking just at what people are earning misses some of the inequality that might exist in a culture. Do we have time for one more question? Or it's very bright up here, so we can't actually see anybody.
Thank you all. That was very, very interesting, and I learned a lot. I just want to make the point about being healthy or not healthy as a vegan. So I think if I switch from McDonald's burgers and fries washed down with a Coke to vegan burger and fries washed down with a Coke, I can't really expect any huge changes to my health or weight or, you know. But if I choose to eat a healthy diet and actually mindfully, carefully eat a healthy diet, then I think what I can achieve with a vegan diet is far more than people who very mindfully, carefully try to eat a healthy meat-based diet.
I think we talk about that in Even Vegans Die, and that part is written by Virginia Messina, a very well-respected nutritionist, and she shows where, according to some of the studies, the benefits from veganism come, and how in heart disease, et cetera. But the fact is, not for any of us to be trapped that you might end up with familial high blood pressure, familial cholesterol. You might end up with breast cancer even as a vegan. It's not that it's not healthy. We're not saying it's not healthy, but we should not fetishize its healthiness as being the be-all and end-all of veganism. Because the other thing that happens then, if we get someone to become vegan because they're going to be healthier, and they don't get healthier, how does that help the animals? Because they stop being vegan. Why can't the vegan movement hold on to its original inception idea that we don't need to eat animals or animal products because it's not good for the animals? Why do we have to find something that's appealing to self-interest? Why can't we see the movement as creating compassion and that the animal themselves matter? And that perhaps the healthiest thing I'm doing for myself is that I care.
I feel like that's a pretty good place to leave it off then, unless anyone else has any quick question, but. All right, so.
I wanted to throw in from my 25
please.
Points, I'm sorry. when others fail to recognize the work of women in the movement, remedy this. Don't perpetuate the invisibility of women's work. And if you work for a vegan organization, introduce and enforce a zero tolerance policy against sexual harassment. So I just wanted to throw out a couple very specific things.
Cool. Any more you'd like to add? We got a couple minutes.
Read the sexual politics of meat and understand that my book is talking about and to men in this movement too.
Right on. So Carol, how can people follow your work if they want to? Obviously, they can pick up your books. Any social media you would direct them to?
I have a website, caroljadams.com. I'm on Twitter at _CarolJAdams. I have a Facebook page where I'm constantly interacting, posting new terrible examples of the sexual politics of meat, and you can find that. I don't do very well on Instagram.
Well, let's give it up for Carol Adams one more time.
Yeah. And if for some reason you want to hear us talk more, we'll be behind the Compassion Co. booth, which is across from...
Globally Local Food Truck.
That one.
Yeah, come on out. We got buttons and stickers and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
If people want to come see me, September 23rd, Chicago Vegan Mania. September 30th, Phoenixville Veg Fest. October 1st, Vegan Food Drink Fest in New York. I don't expect to see any of you there, but hopefully the listening
let's
audience.
Let's a shout out to these two wonderful bearded vegans.
All right, Paul. So as we were visiting Toronto, I realized Toronto actually has seven letters in the name.
Yes.
And those seven letters actually are an acronym that correspond to the following phrase.
We are the Bearded Vegans, signing off. Thank you so much. And thank you again to Kevin and Wally and all the tech crew and everyone that helped put this together.
It's been a blast. So thank you all for coming
Thank you.
Out.
So, without further ado, I will present the Bearded Vegans.
Without further ado, let's do this.
Yeah, so you may know her as the author of The Sexual Politics of Meat and the co-author of the new book, Even Vegans Die. Please welcome Carol Adams.
Anyway, so I know Kevin already asked, but who here is a beardo in the crowd?